Thank you very much. Thank you particularly to Pieta and Tuomo and Eva and Otto and all the other people who've organized to get me here and to make this visit a reality. We've been talking about getting together for a long time, and so it's wonderful to be finally here. So thank you for this opportunity to speak. And what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about feminist inspirations for the work that Julie Graham and I've done as J.K. Gibson Graham, but the ongoing kind of inspiration that feminism gives to our work, trying to reimagine and enact different kinds of economies. So, clearly feminism, I think, for us has been an example of a social movement that's had revolutionary impact in society. Over the past 3 to 4 generations, I think we could say that feminism has literally transformed societies in many ways. Of course, there's a long way to go in terms of transformations we'd like to see. But this image, I think, from this Asian journal illustrates to some extent the successes of feminism as a social movement in terms of what it has liberated for women. So if we think about the kind of impact that feminism's had, and I guess the reason I'm bringing this up is because the question that Julie and I asked when we started to work on rethinking the economy was, why was it that feminism had a revolution in some part, but as those of us interested in other kinds of economies, we still had to wait, particularly as those of us who saw ourselves as Marxists in the 80s and 90s. So feminists could have a revolution, but that Marxists always had to wait for this other moment. And the revolution for feminists that feminism has created was, I think, to reframe what it meant to be a woman, bringing the kind of hidden stories, histories, or her stories of who holds up half the world, as we saw in that image before, to the fore, liberating the kind of ways in which feminism has produced different roles that women can take up. And importantly, I guess, for those of us who are interested in theory, the way that feminism has prompted a different way of thinking about the world, and one that's put care and life and interconnection to the centre of the stage. So the question then, in terms of this unfinished kind of project of transformation, is what about feminism and the economy? What kind of shifts and changes has feminism as a social movement wrought in the economic sphere? And so what I think has been clear is that feminists have produced a kind of inspirational figure ground shift, a representational shift in how we see the economy. And so what I want to do is go through some of the ways in which feminists have done that, have achieved that kind of shift in how we think of the economy these days. And I think we can see a number of related strategies. They're somewhat different, and I'll try and perhaps differentiate a little bit the strategies that I've developed with Julie and others in the Community Economies Collective from what's gone before. But there's definitely a history and a genealogy and a way of building on the shoulders of the previous theorists that is very important to recognise. So all the strategies that feminists have adopted have had some kind of influence on policy and on practices. And most of them, I think, could be classified as a form of discursive politics, where there have been a challenge to the way in which the whole economy is seen, and new metaphors or representations of that whole have been proposed with new techniques of measuring or enumerating what that economy is. And all of these approaches have tried to bring what has been hidden to the fore, this classic kind of move to reveal what has been hidden. So what I want to do is go through some of the kind of representations of the economy that feminists have developed in this kind of quest to complete the whole, see the whole in a more complete way with women in the picture, and then talk about some of the more deconstructive moves that I've been involved in with kind of queering the economy and taking a slightly different feminist strategy forward, and then come to looking at some of the ways in which we can look at women's economic activism in what I'll introduce to you as a diverse economy. So that's the kind of structure of the talk. I'm adding in the economic activism here, and I hope I'll be able to hear examples from your experience in Finland around some of the challenges for women's economic activism in the current period. Okay, so a lot of the focus, I think, of feminist rethinking has been to look at the exclusion of feminist activities or feminized activities from the economy. So there's been a challenging of what is the boundary of the economy and trying to shift that boundary between what has been traditionally considered economic and what's been considered non-economic. And so in doing this, I think feminists have worked within this kind of discursive terrain, which I'll later on come to critique a little bit, but a terrain that sees the economy as bounded, a bounded whole that can be kind of transparent and knowable, this kind of thing called the economy. And this kind of vision has a genealogy. This vision of an economy has come from somewhere. And, you know, many people trace back the term economy to its component parts, oikos, in Greek, meaning the household or habitat, and nomos, meaning the management of that household or the management of habitats. So the feminist historian Mary Poovey traced the emergence of this idea of the economic as a separate domain back to the late 16th and early 17th centuries, where people started talking about the economy as somehow separate from politics and from theology. So it was a new field where, you know, some kind of knowledge could be created. And she turns to writings of a prominent English merchant, Edward Misselden, in 1623, where he talked about the economy as an abstracted thing, an abstracted economy, literally realized in the form of a giant glass globe that the king can enter and consult at will. So there's this image of this glass globe in which the world could be seen from a particular perspective. And he proposed that merchants who were at that time developing double entry bookkeeping, this way of trying to map out inputs and outputs and costs and benefits, this kind of system of accounting, were able to start to track and keep track of the ebb and flow of goods and bills of exchange that was happening with the kind of rise of merchant capitalism, particularly with the world trade that was developing at that time. And this kind of double entry bookkeeping would give an accurate account of what was coming in and out and give advice to the king, who could then contemplate how to manage trade and commerce within his kind of nation, his giant glass sphere. So this image of a kind of a spherical object which relationships were kind of constrained within and bounded within, in which there were calculative transactions taking place, kind of dates right back to this early period, really at the kind of beginnings of rise of merchants. And of course, in that, only certain practices and exchanges were recognized as economic. So writing a few centuries later, Nassau Senior, writing in 1836, said, well, we can include women's labor or female labor when it's labor market activity, when it's producing commodities for sale, but we can't think about feminist activity taking place in the home because that isn't producing transferable objects for explicit exchange. So we see right from this early stage the way in which the notion of the economy is based on the exclusion of certain kinds of labour or certain kinds of work. And what is included in the economy is a form of market exchange that's involving money and commodities. So the idea of that really feminists have had to work against is this sense of exclusion, the way in which certain kinds of work, certain kinds of realms are outside of the real economy and certain things are inside it. Now, as you probably can recall, another political economist working in the 19th century, namely Karl Marx, kind of had a way around this to some extent, in that he recognised there was a whole lot of labour going on in households and other sites outside of these commodity-producing processes. But in his view, this was a different sphere. This was the sphere of reproduction that was reproducing the workers that would go into the real economy where capital accumulation would take place. So he had a similar kind of exclusion, which many people have still found a productive kind of dualism even today. But early on, then, in this construction of a discursive unit called the economy, it was clear that not only was excluding certain things and including other things important, but counting and measuring was also important to proclaiming the reality of this thing called the economy. So the kind of double-entry bookkeeping was very central for many years to this analysis of what was in the economy. So I suppose really what's happened over the years or the last century or a half is that feminist thinkers have really tried to enlarge the scope of what we consider is the economic, and have challenged these processes of exclusion and processes of measurement head on by proposing different strategies. And the strategies that they've proposed are ones that the strategies that they've adopted are ones where we try and add on and to what is included in the economy and count in. So I'll just talk a little bit about some of those, the work that's gone on under those kind of headings. And each of the interventions has drawn on different metaphors. And as you can tell, economy is often represented through metaphorical thinking, whether it's the laws of physics and or this notion of a globe or a sphere. You know, there's always a kind of metaphorical element to the way in which economy is spoken about. And in our society, it's often represented as a sort of machinic kind of relationship, where there's these hydraulic kind of relationships between investment and flow and this kind of thing. So it's worth taking notice of what kind of metaphors are being used and then what the impact of those metaphors are. So I'll just look at some of the kind of ways in which the economy, non-economy binarism has been rethought. In a sense, we've talked about one already, this idea that the economy is where real production takes place, where wealth is generated, where goods and services are, as objects are transacted, and where money is exchanged. And this is as opposed to this other sphere that's seen as the sphere of reproduction, where in many ways wealth is consumed rather than generated, in one view. So the sphere of production and reproduction really, which has informed a lot of socialist feminist thinking and comes out of a kind of Marxian lineage, also, of course, is traced back to organic thinking, this representation of an organism that has to reproduce itself, this kind of biological vision of an organism with lifelike capacities for reproduction and death, or in the Marxian sense, crisis, that then gives rise to the new birth of a new form of accumulation and so on. So that's been one kind of way in which then the work of women has been subsumed into this sphere of reproduction. And of course it's honoured the kind of caring labour and the biological production of the new of people and so on. Another way of thinking about including or adding into the economy has come from Nancy Fulbray's work, where she says, let's look at the kind of ways in which monetized values are exchanged in the economy and the action of the invisible hand works, which is the concept that Adam Smith talked about, you know, the invisible hand of the market, where supply and demand is kind of equilibrated through this, you know, this market operation that, if it's left to be free, somehow is it produces equity and so on. So this idea that there's one kind of invisible hand taking place in monetized realms of exchange, and she juxtaposes that to this other sphere where non-monetized values are generated and distributed by this invisible heart of care. So she really takes up this whole idea of caring practices and a different kind of organization that comes out of more principles of care and ethics of care rather than the kind of economic, hard economy, cold economy relationships of the market. So there's the sense in which the economy is where the invisible hand is, but we need to include all those activities that are also part of invisible heart work. Another feminist, Genevieve Vaughan, has focused a lot more on this other sphere that she associates with women's activities, where she sees gift giving as very central. And she sees that as a kind of extension of the mothering and nurturing of new life. So she sees this as a sphere that resists any kind of measurement or calculation of commensurability, that gift-giving, care-giving is something where you're not expecting a return that you are going to kind of calculate. So here she sees the exchange area, the what's been on that left-hand side of the binarism, as where plunder takes place, where exploitation takes place, where the relations of exchange and commodification are continually trying to invade this other sphere, where gift-giving, where emotional and nurturing labor takes place. And that a lot of the service, service occupations that were once done in a non-monetized way are now being invaded by the kind of exchange economy. So her view of the whole is to include this space where gift-giving and non-commensurate relationships and transactions take place. So all of these kind of positionings are a way of trying to include the excluded other into this vision of what is the economy. And another, I guess, very popular vision is a slightly different, can't be represented quite in the same binaristic way, but is the vision that's been put forward by Hazel Henderson. And she represents the economy as having these multiple layers, the layer cake, where the traditional economy, what we often talk about, or economists talk about as the traditional economy, is just the icing on the cake, this kind of private sector of business where people are working and producing commodities for exchange. And they also somewhat talk about the public sector, of course, where state enterprise or state activity is a big focus for public policy and public sector economics. But underneath it are what she calls the ignored economy or the non-monetized economy, where we see underground relationships, the love economy, which for her would be the care economy, the economy of the invisible heart. And she also includes nature, the way in which nature is providing all these, goods and services, or that's often how the way ecological economics likes to see what nature is providing. But it's providing care, it's providing open access commons that are all sustaining these top layers of the layer cake. And still, for her, a dualism is embedded in this kind of vision of the monetized and the non-monetized economy. So it's sort of, it's building on the same kind of relationships that I illustrated on the previous slide. Another kind of version of the layer cake is the one that Veronica Benhold Thompson and Maria Mies put out in 1999. It's presenting itself as an iceberg, which is interesting because we also use an iceberg vision. But here she's got the layers, the capitalist and wage labor are the people that are producing commodities for exchange at the top. That's the visible economy. And then underneath it is this invisible economy that's not counted in, that's not part of the GNP, or the gross national product, where you have homework, informal work, the underground economy in Hazel Henderson's terms. But she is taking a global perspective now, which is quite different from a lot of the other feminist work that's really working in more minority world economies or developed world economies. She's looking at the role that peasants' work plays, housework across the whole world, the work in colonies and also in nature. So she's adding into this kind of vision, the work that's taking place internationally. And similarly, there's a sort of, again, the same binarism and the way in which these economies are almost seen as operating in some kind of a layer that is then providing a base upon which everything else is resting. And again, it's this kind of attempt to complete the whole. Okay, so this is the kind of ways in which feminists, I think, have tried to produce different metaphors that have tried to say the whole is more than what the mainstream economists think of. But there's been much more kind of work in a technical vein as well to actually count women's work and this other labour. So this is the kind of work that has been inspired particularly by Marilyn Waring's book in the 1980s, which was the two versions of it. One was called If Women Counted, and the other was Counting for Nothing. And she argued that we needed to count women's unpaid work and give it an imputed monetary value, because then we could start to see the way in which it stacked up against the kind of work that was calculated and measured in national accounts like that give rise to indicators like the gross domestic product or gross national product, which is a kind of way of accounting for economies that was developed in the 20s and 30s and really took off in the 50s, where every national account, the national economy, then was able to represent itself in terms of the value of goods and services that were transacted in particular sectors and how much value was created. So we actually talked about this morning, that the Finnish GDP or gross domestic product project was initiated in the 50s and where, you know, sectors were identified, commodities were measured, and a whole vision of what the value of the Finnish economy was as opposed to other economies. And these are all the kind of metrics that you often hear reported at in the global kind of ranking, who's got the highest GDP, who's got the lowest GDP. This all sort of ranking of economies is a way of showing their worth somehow. So what Marilyn was saying was we need to challenge that representation and start to measure all this unpaid labour that women are doing. And in fact, Duncan Ironmonger, who's a kind of feminist economist in a sense in Australia, has done this kind of work. And he's proposed that if you do measure it, you'll find that in many, and certainly in the Australian case, the value of unpaid household work is equal to the value of the work going on in the sort of formal sector. So he argues for this idea of a gross household product as well as a gross domestic product, and that we should have a system of national accounts that is comprised of the gross household product and the gross market product as a way of kind of balancing out and seeing who's contributing what. And in fact, that measurement of unpaid labour has been taken up all around the world now, that many countries do try and impute or measure unpaid labour and caring labour, volunteer labour in certain sectors in order to try and show, you know, who's keeping up the world. You know, it's not just a certain kind of production. And Nancy Fulbray, the feminist economist from the US, also has employed this way of trying to produce new metrics to count and give economic value to what are often seen as non-economic activities. So she talks about, instead of just having things like the Dow Jones Index to look at economic health, she proposes something called the Dolly Jones Index instead of the Dow Jones. And this tracks the changes in imputed value of time that people are doing work in their homes and communities. So, you know, imagine on the nightly news, if you didn't just have the Dow Jones being shown and its fluctuations up and down, but you had the Dolly Jones Index as well. This is her kind of intervention in trying to shift the discourse around what we consider as economic. So if you kind of take all these kinds of feminist approaches of adding on and counting in, you can see that they aim to demonstrate the importance of what were once seen as non-economic activities. So housework, unpaid work, caring and nurturing activities, building of social relationships and networks, and even in some cases, like Hazel Henderson, the value, and Maria Mies's work, the value of kind of Mother Nature. So they argue that the economy as it now stands isn't a kind of self-contained and autonomous sphere as it's often assumed, but it at the moment, the way it's represented in economic theory and how it's taught in universities and so on is lacking and incomplete. And so the strategy has been to try and make this thing, this concept, this object, complete and whole, and to add in all these missing parts. So in a sense, they're all still part of the same kind of lineage or the same genealogy as a kind of, as these notions, these traditional notions of the economy that have constructed it as a kind of bounded entity that can be known by, through enumeration, and through taking apart its parts and adding them up to the whole. And these kind of strategies have led to particular kinds of politics, and they have implications then for emancipatory and transformative projects that feminists have advocated. And I guess you could start to see different strands of feminism picking up on different elements of these representations. So often a more conservative feminist approach is to say, well, you know, women's work in the home should be valued equally as men's work in the workplace, or, you know, that we should eliminate any disadvantages that there are for women to stay in their homes and make things more equal. Whereas many socialist feminists, certainly in the early days of the women's movement, said, well, you know, women should get out of the home. Let's get out of domesticity. This is where our oppression is. You know, we should get out into the mainstream workforce and argue for equal wages there. And, you know, we should argue for childcare and all sorts of things that allow women to be freed from this particular sphere. And more radical feminists have tried to do the other thing, which is to say, no, let's validate this caring sphere, this sphering of gift-giving, where non-exploitative relationships are supposedly the norm. And let's try and, you know, build that economy and ignore the rest. You know, there's been strategies that really can be tapped back to many of these different kind of positions, I suppose, of coming down on do we equalize, do we shift over to one side, do we shift to the other? And there's a sort of sense of, I guess, a bit of a sense of essentialism that comes into these kinds of politics. And I guess the concern that I've had, or that Julie and I had, and Jenny Cameron, who worked on this issue and published a paper on it quite a while ago now, is that we were concerned with this kind of realist epistemological approach to trying to complete the economy, and once we've got it completed, then we'll somehow know what kind of politics to pursue. Because what we were worried about is the ways in which there's still a kind of, in any binarism, a master signifier. There's still this sense in which no matter how much you try and add in, the signifier of the real economy stays put, and everything is kind of made in relation to this. And here you can see the kind of similar critique that women, that post-structuralism has made within feminist theorizing, that if we keep trying to redefine women always in relation to man, we keep this master signifier there as the center, as the central sort of figure within any kind of discursive system, and trying to you know, see women as other to man, or dependent on man, or subordinate, or better, or transformative, or something, is always keeping this kind of central figure in place. So the idea that somehow by increasing our ability to describe the economy by adding in and counting in, taking these kinds of representational political strategies further forward, that this trying to get more accuracy wasn't necessarily going to lead towards a transformative politics, because really what we need to think about is how do we transform the economy, not just add women into it. And you can think of the ways in which, you know, even mainstream economics has kind of flowed into this sphere of the non-economy by starting to document in more neoclassical terms the new home economics and using game theory, for instance, to look at interactions in the household and map them back onto economic relationships, or take up these social networks and see them all as just forms of social capital. You know, oh, they're just, instead of, you know, physical capital and intellectual capital, now we have social capital, which is a kind of way of getting into this sphere and saying, yes, we can account for these other things that you've said we've left out, but we'll account for it in our way that still sees certain kinds of economic theorizing unchallenged. So I guess the sort of strategy that Gibson Graham adopted was to start to think in a different way about reframing the economy, not so much by adding into a realist vision of it, but by starting to queer the economy, deconstruct this binarism by looking at the radical heterogeneity that we could see on both sides of that kind of slash or that divide. So central to this strategy is the idea that we have economies of difference and that we have multiple and unfixed economic identities, so that many of us could occupy many of these positions, you know, within the paid workforce, within households, within communal practices, and many of these things are coexisting in particular in any one subject, particular they could even be coexisting in any one sector. So, for instance, if you look at the childcare sector, you can see how this is a care sector that has many different kinds of economic organisation operating in it, from household care in families to people working in their households to look after children for money, to cooperative childcare centres, to capitalist childcare centres. There's many different kinds of practices that are going on there, and we can't necessarily separate them out into more exploitative or less exploitative. We need to do some more work to do that. So I guess our approach has been to kind of empty out the economy from any kind of essential identities or logics or organizing principles or determinants, and see the economy as this kind of more open-ended construct made up of multiple constituents. And I think it's more similar to the work that Hazel Henderson and has done, where she starts to look at the ways in which we can't see only Mother Nature operating outside of the economy. It's operating up in the marketized sector. Social cooperation is happening in some businesses where commodities are transacted, as well as in ones where they're, there's social enterprises. So she starts to, that layer cake vision in her work actually starts to mix up, and she starts to see different things happening outside of these layers all over the place. So in a sense, she is starting to do the kind of work that we felt we needed to do by theorizing what we call the diverse economy. And so our iceberg vision is another one that draws on that notion that there's something invisible, but we aren't really allying. We're not kind of drawing these chaotic other kinds of activities into any particular order at this stage, although I will in a minute. So up in the top of the iceberg, we still have, you know, formal wage labor producing commodities in major businesses, which is kind of where most economic theory is focused. But underneath the iceberg, we have all sorts of activities going on, including ones that sometimes use money, sometimes don't, sometimes use care practices, sometimes don't, sometimes use cooperation, sometimes use theft, and so on. What we're trying to point to is that there's multiple forms of labour that make up an economy, multiple forms of ways of exploiting or of appropriating value, multiple ways of transacting, multiple ways of owning and of financing. And the ways in which we've kind of, we can start to divide those up into the work that women do and men do, and this is just an image of the iceberg economy transposed into the Pacific context, where it's a floating coconut. And it was a way of mapping onto the floating coconut what women did and what men did in Melanesia and Solomon Islands and Fiji. And And what it shows is that, you know, for most, many countries of the world, and particularly in the Pacific, most people are involved in activities that are outside of what is largely seen as the real economy. So, you know, they're all making livings and producing livelihoods by not largely intersecting the kind of things where that economic theory focuses on. But the way that which we tried to unpack this is through this idea of diverse economies, where we can talk about wage labour, but we can also start to look at all the ways in which people are involved in alternative forms of paid labour, such as self-employment, where people pay themselves a wage, but often a very small subsistence wage if they're running a small business, the ways in which many people work in a reciprocal relationship with others, particularly in agricultural sectors where people work on each other's farms and then other people come and work on yours, and there's a kind of a reciprocity. It's a form of a calculation, but it's really a reciprocal relationship. Many jobs in which people are paid in kind by food or housing, and of course ways in which people are paid for working through various benefits that accrue from the state. And on, as well as all these kinds of activities, we see all the unpaid activities that many of the feminist theorists have focused on, housework, volunteering, but particularly self-provisioning, which is, you know, making your own food, growing your own food. And in our vision of the diverse economy, I guess it's an attempt to do an inventory without any valuation at this point. So part of the inventory is to say, let's look at all the kinds of labour that's around, and slave labour is still very much part of our world. It's not something that, you know, in the old visions, slavery was something that preceded industrialism, and or slavery preceded feudalism, and so on. But we actually still see slave labour as part and parcel of a diverse economy. And similarly, if we look at the ways in which transactions take place, we have formal market relationships where commodities are transacted, but we have a lot of other kinds of market transactions where a different kind of ethic enters into the transaction, such as through fair trade networks where the livelihood of the farmers are being considered in the way in which the price of the commodity is being calculated. Alternative currencies like time banks and others where the transaction is pegged to a particular hour of labour, and it doesn't matter if that's, you know, an hour of a dentist's labour or an hour of a painter's labour or a cook. So there's a kind of equalisation of value there. Of course, relations in the underground market, which are often tied to all sorts of relationships of coercion often, and barter relationships where goods are just transacted directly. And then all the other forms of transaction, which again some of the feminist theorists have also focused on, the sharing that takes place in households, the gift giving, the relationships with nature that are happening when people go hunting and fishing, and the kind of ethical relationships that are and aren't enacted about thinking about how much to fish, how much to hunt, how much to leave. Relationships of gleaning, which again are things that many people in the world are still living by, where poor people are allowed into farms that are, or areas that have been harvested in order to pick up what's left. But, you know, a modern day version of this is dumpster diving, I think, where people are going around and gleaning food that's being thrown out. Theft and poaching, other forms of transacting and taking. James Ferguson talks about this as kind of demand sharing often that takes place. Again, trying to do kind of a vision of the economy with everything in it, warts and all. And similarly, we can start to look at the diversity of enterprise forms that aren't just capitalist, where forms of surplus production take place and appropriation and accumulation by private interests. But we can think about other forms of capitalist enterprise, like state-owned firms, where theoretically profits are produced that go back then into the benefit of the rest of the national populace. Whether that happens or not is doubtful, but sometimes it does. And non-profit firms, and then all the sorts of non-capitalist economic enterprises such as worker cooperatives, sole proprietorship, which is self-employment, which is probably the form of business enterprise that's dominant in the world, if you think about it. Forms of community enterprise and also still slave and feudal enterprise, which we can see operating in particular parts of the world. And in our vision, we also then add in relations of property, which is very central to how economies run, where we have not just individualized private property, but many forms of alternative private property, in some cases where there's ways in which communities are starting to common those forms of property, such as in state assets or customary land and so on. And all the open access property that is struggled over at the moment in terms of who has access to caring for or polluting or expropriating and enclosing, such as IP, international waters and so on. And lastly, one can start to look at the diverse economies of finance or the different kinds of ways that, as well as mainstream finance, we see other forms of financial institutions that try and service a particular community, like a credit union or microfinance. And then the many non-market forms of finance that could take the monetary form in terms of family lending or interest-free loans, or could take another form like sweat equity, where you put labor in and then you gain a stake in a future. So I guess by doing this kind of diverse economy inventory, it's not easy to kind of try and read off the credits and the debits in the way that the double entry bookkeeping kind of tried just to see where's the good, where's the bad, where's the exploitation, where's the non-exploitation. What we need to do now is to start to think about how we work with the specificity of this diverse economy to build different kinds of economies that are transformative. And I think women's economic activism has taken place in many parts of this diverse economy to try and build and produce different kinds of economic futures. So rather than seeing us as, moving on to trying to have policies that are on one side of that binarism or the other, our work has been interested in the kind of radical heterogeneity of feminist economic activism across the diverse economy. And so here, a transformative economic politics might advocate then the proliferation of diverse economic forms, and particularly ones that promote some kind of positive social value or a self-directed structure, that are the kinds of things that feminists have seen as taking place in the domestic sphere or in the care economy. So it's not that care economy can only be in certain sectors. The caring relationship can be in any sector, including across the whole of the diverse economy, and we're interested in those places where those kind of caring relations of interdependency are being fostered as a way of building economies that are centered on ethical interactions rather than on these kind of mechanistic actions of supply and demand or market relationships. So we could start to see activities across the diverse economy where there's some kind of nurture or cooperation or sharing or giving or attentiveness to nature taking place, as well as, and those are all the kind of qualities that were traditionally coded feminine, but as well as the kind of more masculine qualities such as independence, experimentation, leadership, adventurousness, and all these so-called masculine-like qualities. And so if we could start to put those together in different places, I guess our interest has been in trying to foster contexts in which more non-capitalist economic activities are developed, where the surplus that's created flows to those that need it and flows back to environments to repair them on the basis of kind of ethical principles of connection. So what I'd like to do is talk about then the kinds of economic activism that I guess we can think of in this diverse economy, and some of the ways in which the work that I've done in various contexts has worked with different kinds of economic activism that women have been involved in. And here I'm really thinking about the ways that women have shifted the debate in these spheres of work, in business, in markets and transactions, in property and in finance, to focus on taking back the economy for real, for people, for livelihoods, and for planetary health. And these are some of the things that I've written about in this book with Jenny Cameron and Stephen Healy that I'm actually going to be lecturing on more tomorrow. But in this book, we try and say, let's look at the ways in which we can shift the concern away from the idea that we work for in the workforce in order to get money to live. Let's think about all the different forms of labor we do and the ways in which they contribute to surviving well together and surviving with the earth. So we're trying to shift the focus of, you know, questions around why do we work into this realm of what we call community economy concerns, concerns for each other, for our interactions with each other and with our earth. So rather than thinking about work, we think about surviving well together. Rather than thinking about business, we think about all the different ways that enterprise is a focus for developing and distributing surplus. Rather than thinking about markets, we think about these ethical encounters we have through the different kinds of transactions that we are involved in, whether it's through market or non-market relationships. And similarly, when we're thinking about property, we're interested in practices of commoning, making access to property open so that it actually helps to share resources in the world. And then thinking about finance more as a sense of investing in futures and how do we marshal our resources to invest in futures rather than just put them into a kind of a gambling sphere of financial destruction. And lastly, how do we consume sustainably? So I can't talk about feminist economic activism in all those realms, but I will talk about them in the first two. So in the early work that I did on women's economic activism, it was actually in the coal mining industry in Australia. And there's always been a very kind of ambivalent relationship that women have played to male-dominated resource sectors. Their activism has often been limited to supporting men, to helping men in their struggles. And this is a picture from the British coal miners' strike where women were a really key element supporting the men to try and maintain their jobs. And so women's economic activism has often been seen in that light as limited only to kind of a support role as opposed to an advanced role that tries to reshape and transform. But of course, as women have moved into the paid workforce, there's been a lot of campaigns to try and change the conditions of work, particularly for women workers, and all the work around outwork and in clothing sector has been, and many other kind of female-dominated industries, has been to try and increase the rights that women have in those sectors. And in Australia, there's been a major case now where women in the care sector have been able to get recognition for large wage rises to respect the work that they're doing. They've always been in this kind of sector that's had very low wages, and the one of the unions has taken up their call to main, you know, to argue for higher wages in those care professions. So there's always been economic activism then that is, in a sense, in that the top of the iceberg, the tip of the iceberg, trying to get a better deal for women workers or a better deal for men in the capitalist workforce. So these are kind of forms of economic activism that have been trying to argue that working people who are in the wage labour market should have more survival wages, you know, better minimum wages, fair workplaces. And this has been an important place for women's economic activism alongside men. But another, that's again, as I said, that's in that tip of the iceberg. It potentially isn't necessarily transformational or revolutionary. It's working within the bounds of economies as we've known them rather than trying to shift the nature of what economies are. So the question is, what kind of activism has taken place in the rest of this diverse economy, and what are women doing in that area? Well, one of the areas that I've worked in a little bit is the ways in which feminist economic activism has focused on these very underpaid and legally questionable areas of indentured labour. and particularly arguing for better wages and recognition and legal recognition. And the case of domestic workers all around the world, but particularly those that come from Asia and work in countries like Hong Kong or Canada, has been one of the key kind of a key focus of activism. And here we're really arguing for the rights of labour that is indentured. You know, people who are on contracts for 2 years, where they are really under the authority of a family, often living in the kitchen, you know, on a pull-out bed, only allowed 1 day off a week, have nowhere to go apart from these public spaces in Hong Kong where domestic workers spend their Sundays. They kind of construct little lounge rooms out in public space, cook their food, sit around and chat, because they don't have anywhere else other than the house that they're working in or the apartment they're working in. And so there's been a movement to try and challenge the nature of this form of indenture and allow women in these conditions to perhaps live outside homes and have more rights. So there's a lot of work to do, I think, in this field of trying to work with indentured labourers and even slavery, and of course the whole sex slavery area of feminist economic activism and child slavery is another area that is very important in the diverse economy. There's also, I guess, ways in which there is activism around self-employment and helping people to who are working in self-employed or family businesses to share the benefit of this kind of labour. And some of the work I've done in the past in Papua New Guinea was with small family tenant farmers in the oil palm industry, where men were being paid to harvest oil palm and women were expected to, as part of the kind of family business, go and harvest as well. But the men never paid the women any money for doing that work. And one of the companies decided to change the payment structure so that women would be paid separately for the oil palm that they collected, which was largely the separate droplets, not the big bunches here. And they produced a project called the Loose Fruit Mama project, where women had their own payment card to be paid for the piles of fruit that they collected, so that they didn't have to get into these negotiations with their husbands, which often ended in violence, or if the husband went off and, you know, drank the paycheck that week. So there's kind of ways in which these relationships in the home that intersect with market relationships are a place of struggle, and feminist activism has played a role here. So here's a mama with her loose fruit, and because it's separated out, the company was able to pay her separately to the man. And then, of course, as often the case, she went and put that money into household goods and children's education and all the things that have elevated women to be the kind of subject of development these days. Everyone says, well, women are responsible. Let's give the money to them, not men. You know, and this certainly was borne out in this case in Papua New Guinea. Although what happened from this project was then there was an idea of trying to pay young men separately as well, because they are also suffering from not being able to get their payment from their fathers. So there's an interesting kind of family dynamics there, which was a side of struggle. So the other part of economic activism that I've been interested in is women's role in developing alternative enterprises, particularly community enterprises, where the enterprise develops some kind of has a social good, but also if it has an economic good, it's distributed back into the community. So surplus is generated in order to flow back into community well-being. And the projects that I've been involved in have largely been in the Philippines and also in Australia, developing small community-based enterprises, such as this one, which is using local resources, the ginger in the area of the Philippines that this community is in, and older women who have got skills, who have joined together and use often some of the traditional techniques of reciprocity that they're are used to doing in the farming sector, to combine and build a community enterprise that is producing this ginger tea, which is marketed locally. And they did a lot of research on market development and feel very proud of this enterprise that they've generated, which has allowed them to have a small amount of cash to help with medical bills and spectacles and other kinds of things. It's not a business that's going to ever scale up and become a large capitalist business, but it's a business that's very integrated in circulating value within the small community, the rural community in which they're living. And their objective as older women is to try and develop an enterprise that young women can start to work in earn some cash that will help them to stay in their community rather than offer themselves as domestic workers overseas, which is the way many young women see themselves as getting ahead in this community, is to often leave their children with older relatives to go and work for somebody else in another part of the world looking after their children in order to have the money to send their children to school. So this whole kind of trying to intersect these international market relations by developing local value through alternative kinds of enterprise. So as I said, this enterprise draws on many of the traditional practices of labour exchange, patronage networks, barter. So it's kind of cobbling together a hybrid sort of an enterprise with the objective of providing purposeful work that will allow people to have to live well within their community and have some of the economic, some of the access to cash that they need to help with things that have become monetized, like healthcare. Okay, so I guess this is just illustrating the kinds of economic activism in this case, they're drawing on all these different relationships within a diverse economy in order to make the community enterprise work: fair trade, barter, reciprocal labour, in-kind labour, and so on. Another example of the development of alternative enterprises is this one by SEWA, the Self-Employed Women's Association. And this is a large organisation in India that employs that is an organising vehicle for self-employed women. It's a union of self-employed people, which is interesting. And they've also got into the development of cooperatives, not-for-profit businesses, drawing on the craft, sewing, embroidery skills of relatively poor women, developing a mechanism to then, through engagement with international markets, develop the opportunity to support households in poor families where women are often still engaged in farming work, but also are able to access a different kind of labour, a different kind of work, as co-owners of a business. So this is an interesting kind of cooperative business model that's being pushed by Daisewa, and what they're producing are goods that are then marketed to international consumers. So you can see that there's a kind of way in which there's a relationship with international markets, and yet there's an attempt to build different kinds of economic enterprise with a cooperative structure, with wages that are coming through cooperation, and staying again within a particular society where supports are being given to stay connected to community, to culture, but also tapping into some of the benefits that can flow through worker cooperativism and international markets. And so you can see here that there's the kind of economic activism is quite is diverse, and it is puts together many different kinds of activities within a diverse economy. It's not a simplified model, but it's a model that I think is trying to investigate the kinds of new forms of economic interdependence that we can develop within this a reframed economy in which we're not trying to just make it more whole and get people to see that everything's there, but we're trying to actually transform the nature of this economy and give more oxygen to those economic relationships that are actually enacting some of the feminist principles that feminist theorists have been concerned to bring to visibility and to, get the world to kind of accept as central to living well with each other and living well in our ecological environment. So I think what's interesting here is that there is a kind of ways in which this this activism could be seen as trying to challenge the vision that there's one pathway to the future, which is through growth. In fact, there's many pathways to well-being, and there's quite a lot of different kinds of strategies that we can see women pursuing. And I think in a way, in that sense, we can see women as taking back the economy in many ways. So I think I'll end it there, and hopefully we'll invite comment and questions.